I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Ruhama King Furman, author of In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's beginning to feel a lot like Pesach these days, what with all the preparations for the coming holiday of matzah and maror and gefilte fish. But the most important work we need to do in these pre-Passover preparation days is to remove what is called chametz from our homes. Chametz or chametz is anything leavened. Bread, cake, cereal, cookies, virtually anything made from grain or fermented versions of grain, including beer or whiskey, all forbidden on the holiday of Passover on the grounds that we are only supposed to eat matzah and other types of unleavened bread and matzah-based products. The week before Passover begins, and the first Seder is this coming Friday night, April 3rd, we Jews are engaged in the process of removing all the leavening from our homes, searching for and eliminating chametz from our dwellings, just as our ancestors did. Of course, we only eat matzah because the Israelites had no time to allow their bread to rise in their haste to escape from slavery in Egypt. But Jewish law extends this requirement to an exhaustive spring cleaning that removes every crumb of bread or grain residue from our homes completely. That process of bedikat chametz, searching for chametz, mechirat chametz, selling the chametz, and finally biur chametz, burning the chametz, which culminates this week, is a complicated observance indeed. So, with Passover almost upon us, starting this coming Friday night, Chag Pesach Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and kosher Passover, we say, greeting each other this time of year, or sometimes just Azisen Pesach, a beautiful Passover. Now, the way we Jewish clergy professionals experience Passover is a little different from the way an ordinary Jew might. Back when I was a cantor in Los Angeles a few decades ago, I remember conducting something like 9 Passover Seders one year. There were the model Seders for the preschool, religious school, and day school, a first night Seder with my family, the second night congregational Seder, 2 interfaith Seders with clergy of other faiths, a Russian immigrant Seder with refusnik songs, and a workman's circle socialist Seder that included no mention of God, but lots about oppressed workers and the solidarity of labor. You know, by the time Passover was over that year, liberation seemed to come from not having to celebrate liberation anymore. I was fervently praying to be free of parsley and hard-boiled eggs, let alone matzah. I'll say more about matzah a little later in the show, by the way. In any case, all that focus on freedom forced me to look at just what the true meaning of Passover really is. We all know that Passover is the ultimate festival of freedom, celebrating our people's liberation from bondage from the Egyptian Pharaoh over 3,000 years ago. That it is the most observed Jewish holiday in the world today, slightly ahead of Hanukkah. We should all know that matzah is the bread of affliction, maror, the bitter herb symbolic of slavery, and that salt water symbolizes the tears of our tyrannized ancestors. But if freedom is truly valued, what exactly does it mean on Pesach? First, it's clear that even more than just a Jewish celebration, Passover is a holiday that carries with it the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of the downtrodden in every society. The references to Moses and Pharaoh are nearly ubiquitous in liberation struggles worldwide, from the American Revolutionary War, in which King George III was called Pharaoh by our founding fathers, to the Civil War, in which Abraham Lincoln was hailed as Moses in the spiritual Go Down Moses, all the way to the 1960s Civil Rights Movement, which again talked about Egyptian pharaohs and freed Israelites. we see the story of the Israelite slaves' liberation used everywhere, from Liberia to South America. There is a chord of absolute clarity that makes this tale universal and quickens the pulse of every people subjugated by another. But in spite of the universalism of its message, Pesach has a particular understanding of what freedom really means that is uniquely Jewish. You see, for Jews, freedom is much more than an absence of slavery. Certainly, slaves are not free. Without liberation from servitude, we would not have had the ability to become free. First, the shackles must be broken. But freedom doesn't end there. In the Passover story, freedom is the conscious, committed decision to serve God. You cannot understand Pesach if you stop with the Exodus, or even stop on the shores of the Red Sea, for the festival only has full meaning with the great events at Mount Sinai when our people chose to serve only God. In essence, freedom is the ability to choose which master to serve, to dedicate our lives to a cause that is greater and more holy than ourselves. Freedom is not simply an absence of coercion. It is a personal and communal statement that we believe in an ethical ideal and that we will choose to serve a moral God of righteousness, justice, and love. Passover is designed to teach not just freedom from slavery, but also the commitment to God, to Judaism, to education and learning, to justice, that are central to a free people's embrace of ethics. It's a great lesson worth learning anew each and every spring. Now, matzah is another matter. For those of you unfamiliar with matzah, on which the ever-popular and tasty communion wafer is based, it's unleavened bread from which all the taste and enjoyment have been carefully eliminated. It's eating with that pesky element of pleasure gone. Let me say this right out loud, right now, and let the crumbs fall where they may. To me, matzah sucks. I know. Rabbis aren't supposed to think this way, or speak this way, of course, but sometimes you just have to go with your gut and your taste buds. Even so, even with matzah, Pesach is a pretty terrific holiday. In our pre-Passover preview of particularly pleasurable passages of Pesach song, here is Sephardic icon Yehoram Gaon singing the classic Ladino song, Quien supiense y entiendense, who knows one, the concluding song to many a Passover Seder in one musical version or another.
Quien supiense y entiendense, alabar al Dio creense, cual es el uno, cual es el uno. Uno es el criador, uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dios creyense, cuáles son los dos, cuáles son los dos, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dios creyense, cuáles son los tres, cuáles son los tres, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dios creyense, cuáles son los cuatro, cuáles son los cuatro, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dios creyense, cuáles son los cinco, cuáles son los cinco, cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el criador, uno es el criador, Baruch Hu Baruch Shemo. Quien supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dios creyense, cuáles son los seis,
cuando son los seis?
Seis días de la semana, cinco libros de la ley, cuatro matres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos de Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador,
uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo.
En su piense y entendiense, alabar al Dios creyense, ¿cuáles son los siete?
¿Cuáles son los siete?
Siete días con el Shabbat, seis días de la semana, cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Criador,
uno es el Criador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo.
That was Moroccan Israeli star Yehoram Gaon singing Kien Supiense, the Ladino version of Echad Mi Yodea, Who Knows One. By the way, you can hear that song, plus lots of fabulous Moroccan Jewish music and dancing at the Mamouna Festival at Temple Emmanuel, Sunday afternoon, April 12th at 1 p.m. Call 520-327-4501 for tickets. One of the very best novels I have read in recent years was a book set in Jerusalem that included great insight and compassion for both Jews and Arabs, and, well, a good deal more. Meet the remarkable writer of that book, In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist, a novel by Ruchama King Fuhrman, when we come back soon on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Ruchama King Fuhrman is an author and let's see, a blogger, a writer who also offers writing services and has a very interesting biography. Born in Nashville, grew up in Virginia and Maryland, and at 17 bought a one-way ticket to Israel. Her mother comes from Casablanca, where her family lived for many centuries. Her father is a third-generation American. She lived and taught in Israel for 10 years. Her latest book, In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist, is an extraordinary novel, my favorite novel, actually, of last year. Good morning and welcome.
No, thank you. I was delighted to hear that. It's your favorite novel of last year.
I really thought it was terrific. I didn't know what to expect. Read a review, bought it, used it for my book club, and everybody thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's very interesting. Tell us a little bit about what led you to become a writer.
Well, it's kind of a silly memory, but I remember in fifth grade, I was a shy sort of a quirky kid, and I just remember writing a story that got me into a lot of trouble. I almost got expelled for that story. This was in Hebrew day school in Washington, D.C., and I remember thinking, writing is power. I remember in fifth grade, I remember enjoying that experience of power, and I was lucky enough to have some great teachers along the way. every couple of years I would have a great writing teacher. And then I guess moving to Israel, where just stories, amazing stories are raining down, it just, how could you just not grab some of these stories and run with them?
You know, in the courtyard of the Kabbalist, there's a very striking female figure, Tamar, who comes in and changes everything, or maybe doesn't. Who is that modeled after?
Tamar? She's not modeled after me, I'll tell you that. To be honest, I don't think I modeled her after anybody. I think that's why I had a little bit of trouble with her. But in a way, she reminds me of the essence of so many of the Jewish women that I met when I was in Jerusalem. I just met a lot of very dynamic, powerful, amazing women. And you see that sprinkled through, like you see it in the Kabbalist's wife, Shandel Bracha. And then you see it in the younger generation in Tamar. I taught Torah when I was in Jerusalem. And I would meet a lot of people who were just starting out on their Jewish path. So, you know, as I'm talking, I do remember there was one woman who rode a motorcycle. And I remember she would go out on these dates and startle the men by asking for a mug of beer in the middle of a date, you know, on these with yeshiva men. And I don't think she's very different from Tamar, but that definitely I got that idea of the motorcycle riding person from her.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we will continue to explore writing and Jerusalem with Ruchama King Fuhrman. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivi non-Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach v'Kasher.
Chag Sameach, Rabbi.
It's Pesach this coming Friday night, this coming Shabbat. It's maybe the most important Jewish holiday of all, with the possible exception of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. In America, it's the most observed festival, maybe with Hanukkah next to it. Let's talk about what Pesach is like in Israel and what that experience is of the great holiday of freedom in the land where Pesach you would think is the most important.
Pesach, beside having the holiday that if a couple's being able to go through this Leila Seder and not...
The night of the Passover Seder.
And not
fight.
Divorce? No, fight. Divorce?
Not
so
divorce.
Their marriage are, you know, blessed at least for the next year.
If you can make it through the Seder, yeah. You're okay. You've got another year.
Legamre. So beside this, Pesach, it's a great time of the year in Israel. It's like spring. So things are still green outside, but the weather is
beautiful,
amazing.
Usually. Very lovely.
So, and for Seders, you know, there is a preparation. And there is a very, very, I would say, strict way to decide where are you with your family this year. If you were last year with your mother-in-law,
then you have to go to your other mother-in-law.
So there is a very fair, you know.
Always divided.
Yeah. But then, again, after Leila Seder, so for the week of Chol HaMoed,
that's the intermediate days of Passover.
You will find all Am Israel, the people of Israel, all around Israel. Again, because it's a great time of year and people will enjoy the land of Israel.
It's a vacation time,
It's a vacation time. And usually, you know, for Sukkot and for Pesach, it's the only time for religious people to be able to enjoy the holiday, because the rest of it, they need to be in synagogue, of course.
Yeah, of course.
So this is the time you will find all the, you know, religious.
People go on Tiyul, they take trips, they mm-hmm. go to the Galil, the north of Israel, the yes. beautiful area around the
yes,
sea.
Yes, but just if we we'll go back just the night before the night before Leil HaSeder, when we are doing Biur Chametz, when we are looking for the Chametz.
Bedikat Chametz, searching for the Chametz, getting ready to burn the Chametz, the and leftover leaven in the house.
Yeah, and then I think by 10 a.m. the next day, like, you know, the Leil HaSeder day, by 10 a.m. you need to burn all the chametz.
That's
and then
correct, yeah.
we have our own tradition. We will put together with the chametz potatoes, and then we will eat the potatoes.
Oh, so you roast the potatoes yeah, in the
we,
fire?
We don't
wanna yeah, why waste the fire?
Yes.
That's a great tradition. I think we'll try that. You know, I burn my chametz in a chimenea
Lag
here.
Lag
Ba'Omer
and,
so Lag Ba'Omer and Pesach. Listen, there's a great Jewish tradition of combining holidays.
Israel
so.
Is a startup nation. We always, you know.
An innovative way to burn your chametz and roast potatoes at the same time.
Nachon, Rabbi.
It's a great tradition. Chag Sameach, Aziz and Pesach.
Chag Sameach.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
Now, it has come to my attention that my personal dislike of matzah is not shared by every other Jew. In fact, some think my bias against the bread of affliction is non-rabbinic, un-Jewish, slightly blasphemous. And so, in the interests of fairness to the bread of very little flavor, here's the wonderful poet Marge Piercy, a three-time guest of Too Jewish, by the way, and her much more positive spin in her poem called Matzah. Flat you are as a doormat and as homely. No crust, no glaze, you lack a cosmetic glow. You break with a snap. You are dry as a twig split from an oak in midwinter. You are bumpy as a mud basin in a drought. Square as a slab of pavement, you have no inside to hide raisins or seeds. You are pale as the full moon pocked with craters. What we see is what we get. Honest, plain, dry, shining with nostalgia as if baked with light instead of heat. The bread of flight and haste in the mouth you promise home. That was the poem Matzah by Marge Piercy for Pesach, beginning this Friday night. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been exploring the sources of anti-Semitism over the last few weeks. We're up to the period where the Romans are persecuting the Christians, and then something changes quite dramatically.
Right. So, to put it very briefly, by the end of the third century of the Common Era, sort of the 290s, if you will, Roman persecution of Christians had reached a high point. Life was miserable for the Christians. But life, this was also a reflection of the fact that life was miserable for the Romans. They basically were beset by civil wars within, by attacks from barbarians from without. And they divided the Roman Empire first into an eastern and western half, and then each of those halves was subdivided into another half. This was a system that was doomed to fail. And eventually, the man who reunified Rome was a general named Constantine the Great, who won a major military victory against a Roman opponent in Rome at the Ponte Milvio, the Milvian Bridge. And he won that victory in his mind because he had a vision the night before the battle telling him that by converting to Christianity and painting the cross on the tunics of all his soldiers, he would win a huge victory.
Now, there are some people who think, kind of in real politic, that there were a lot of Christians this brought. He was actually outmanned in that. This would bring more into his ranks, and maybe there was also a little political calculation there.
Possibly. But in any case, this actually was the beginning of the whole tradition of so-called militant Christianity, Salvation Army, onward Christian soldiers marching as to war.
Well, crusaders.
Eventually, yes. So Constantine the Great did win. This was like 312 or 313 of the Common Era. And within a decade or so, he decided that the church was a source of disorder and that he was going to make Christianity the state religion of his reunited empire, with a capital in a city that he named after himself, Constantinople. Ancient name was Byzantium. It would return to that name much later. And of course, now it's Istanbul.
Istanbul, right?
But he convened the first really major and hugely important church council, the Council of Nicaea, at a place not far from Istanbul, a town that's now called Iznik, which used to be the ancient Greek city of Nicaea, which was named for the Greek goddess Nike.
The goddess of athletic shoes, by the way.
Right. That produced the Nicene Creed, which is still recited today as the definition of what it means to be a Christian. Now, in the course of the fourth century, the Nicene Creed went through at least a dozen revisions and shifted the emphasis from Jesus as vicar or as shepherd to Jesus as victim, and shifted the emphasis from his life to his death and crucifixion. And because Christianity became the state religion of Rome, Rome could no longer accept the blame for killing the man who was now deemed officially by a united church to have been God as well. So Council of Nicaea both establishes Jesus's divinity and shifts the blame for his death from the Romans, who everybody used to know was responsible, to the Jews. So the Jews become not only the killers of God, which was a charge that would stick around for almost 2,000 years, but also bad Romans, treasonous by definition.
Well, dramatic and important, and we'll continue to follow this story when we come back next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi is opening his mail one morning. Taking a single sheet of paper from an envelope, he finds written on it just one word, schmuck. At the next Friday night Shabbat service, the rabbi announces, "I have known many people who have written letters and forgotten to sign their names. But this week I received a letter from someone who signed his name and forgot to write the letter." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This Friday, we begin the great Festival of Freedom, Passover, the most observed Jewish holiday today, more or less. The Torah readings for Passover, as you might expect, reflect the events of the Exodus in prose, poetry, and ritual. As a festival, Pesach is special in some unique ways. Even the name of the holiday has special importance. Pesach actually has no fewer than four official names in Jewish tradition. Pesach, or Passover, of course, for the Paschal offering, the lamb that was sacrificed and roasted in the days of the Bible and the Temple. Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of Matzah, the unleavened bread we eat for the week of Passover. Chag HaAviv, the springtime festival, probably the oldest of the names of Passover. And, most thematically, Zman Cherutenu, the season of our freedom. Each of these names has something important to teach us, and each is interesting in and of itself. The word Pesach itself comes from the word for leaping or jumping in Hebrew, an apt description of the ways that young lambs leap and cavort in the fields. The use of this animal for the sacrifice of the Passover reminds us that the angel of death leapt over the homes of the Israelites when striking the firstborn of the Egyptians dead, and it also refreshes for us the memory of the leaping joy of freedom, the ability to move and act as we wish, that is, prevented during slavery. Free people can cavort, if you will, skip, dance, jump as they please. Slaves jump to someone else's command. Hence, Chag HaPesach, the holiday of, well, skipping. The second name for Passover is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of the poor man's bread, matzah. Unleavened bread made with flour and water in 18 minutes or less, baked quickly and simply, the food that our ancestors made as preparation for their hasty journey in flight. Of course, on Pesach we eat matzah all week, and therefore do not eat chametz, which is best described as the opposite of matzah, or anything made with leavening or fermentation. That means lots of matzah this coming week. Oh joy. The third name for the festival is Chag HaAviv, the holiday of springtime. Undoubtedly, there was a spring festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led to the creation of this holiday of Passover. Spring is celebrated in every culture and every religion. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meal held the first two nights that teaches the meaning and story of freedom in a rich and wonderful variety of ways. Spring is featured in the green vegetables we dip in salt water and in the hard-boiled egg that symbolizes the rebirth of spring. The magnificent love poem Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs of the Hebrew Bible, is chanted on the Shabbat of Passover. This year, the very first day, and it's a text filled with images of gardens and growth and love and the flowering springtime. A wonderful way to celebrate this most beautiful and verdant of seasons. And finally, the ultimate theme of Passover is freedom. Zman Cherutenu, the time of our liberation. It is this essential ideal that is woven all through the week of Passover, the central focus on God's gift of liberty that has made Pesach the model freedom festival for the world. B'chol dor v'dor, in every generation, each of us is obligated to see ourselves as though we personally had been brought out of Egypt, we are taught in the Haggadah. In addition to our own celebration of our ancestors' freedom, we also are compelled to learn compassion and even empathy for the downtrodden. For when we can view ourselves as survivors of slavery, we are compelled to sympathize with the dispossessed, a central principle in Jewish belief. Whichever name for this fabulous festival you favor, may you be blessed with a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and healthy holiday of Passover. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Ruchama King-Fuhrman, will explain what role Jerusalem plays in her fiction and how Kabbalah influences her work, which is terrific. Meet her again when we come back in a few moments on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
We're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Batsheva Appel.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's relationship with United States President Barack Obama already was tense before Israelis handed him a third consecutive term as Prime Minister last week. But three actions ahead of the election further soured ties. First, there was Netanyahu's March 3rd speech to Congress, arranged with Republicans without the knowledge of the White House. Then, the day before the Israeli vote, in an interview with the Israeli website NRG, Netanyahu rejected a central plank of American policy in the region when he declared that there would be no Palestinian state established under his watch as prime minister, reversing a position he has held since 2009. And on Election Day itself, he urged his supporters to go to the polls by warning that Arab voters are coming out in droves. Netanyahu has walked back his remarks about a two-state solution to some extent and has apologized for his statements about Arab voters. U.S. officials have emphasized repeatedly that the fundamentals of the U.S.-Israel alliance, including close intelligence sharing and security cooperation, remain sound, and they reiterated that position this week. But President Obama has said that he will take Netanyahu at his word in his remarks about no Palestinian state being established under his watch and that options were being reviewed. In Jerusalem this week, hundreds of mourners were present as the seven children who were killed in a house fire in Brooklyn last Shabbat were laid to rest. Police and fire officials were quoted in news reports saying that the fire was caused by a malfunctioning electric hot plate in the family's kitchen that was keeping food warm overnight in observance of the religious restriction on cooking during the 25 hours of the Sabbath. In an archaeological dig in northern Israel, a large bronze mask of the god Pan has been unearthed. The mask was found outside the limits of the ancient city of Hippos, according to a press release issued on Monday by the University of Haifa archaeological team that made the discovery. According to Michael Eisenberg, the team's head, the mask, which is larger than a human head, is extremely rare in its size and in its depiction of the mythological satyr. Anne Frank's cousin, Buddy Elias, her last close living relative and the caretaker of her enormous legacy, died last week at 89 in Basel, Switzerland. Elias was Frank's first cousin, the son of her aunt, and 4 years older than the Amsterdam teen. Frank and her family would often visit their cousins in Switzerland. Their last visit was in 1938, before the family went into hiding in Amsterdam. This is Rabbi Batsheva Appel, and that was the two Jewish news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Ruchama King-Fuhrman. She's the author of In the Courtyard of the Kabbalist, a National Jewish Book Award finalist last year, my favorite Jewish novel of last year, an author of other books, a muse who helps people become better authors, and a blogger as well. Ruchama, in your books, you seem to have protagonists who are a little damaged, bruised, like Isaac. Tell us a little bit, is that a tendency in your writing? Do you know why that happens?
Oh, boy. Well, I guess I'm of the opinion that everyone is damaged and bruised. But then again, my husband's a psychologist, so perhaps that's why. But I think that part of this is definitely something that I'm channeling from my father. My father was somebody who had a very hard life. May his memory be for a blessing. And he was somebody who was physically damaged. He was missing his right ear. And I remember, I think it did have a very strong effect on me. You're definitely picking up on something. One of my main characters in my first novel, Akiva, he has this uncontrollable twitch that comes out of upon him out of nowhere. And I have always had, I would say, a certain attraction to the downtrodden, the people that might be overlooked, the invisible people, the hard luck people. I may not want to marry these characters, but I'm always been a sucker for their stories. And I know that, like, sometimes my husband will, he would bring home some lost soul from, you know, the show on Friday night. My eyes would light up. So I definitely have this attraction to the downtrodden. You got that right.
You know, you do an incredible job of writing about Mustafa, who works on the Temple Mount. Tell us how you conceived of this character, of the sort of definitely downtrodden, lost Muslim, I guess, custodian of the sacred precinct.
Right, and he also has this unusual physical deformity with his neck is turned permanently looking over his right shoulder. His whole life he's been looking over his right shoulder, so much so that he can't see himself when he looks into the mirror. It's as if he's invisible to himself. In this situation, I think it started with place. I wanted to tell, in my mind, the courtyard of the Kabbalist, and then the courtyard that happens on the Temple Mount. They started getting mingled together in my mind. And I wanted to put a character up there, and I wasn't sure who. And then it made sense that it would be a janitor, because the janitor is going to be someone who's going to be exposed to all the religions and the tour guides passing through. He's going to be very broad-minded, even against his will, because he's going to be the repository of so much knowledge, so many different groups, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, everybody's up there, and he's seen it all. So that's how it made sense for him to be a janitor up there. And in terms of his deformity, again, it's part of my shtick, I guess. I find that if I have a lot of pity and a compassion for my character, then it's going to be easier for me to transcend all the different separations. And there were separations. I'm Jewish. I'm a woman. And I'm not poor. I'm not a janitor. So, you know, there were a lot of things that were, I'm from New Jersey, he's from Israel. So there were, I find that by having a dramatic deformity, the character enters my bloodstream, and I can't forget him.
Each of the characters is really quite distinct. By the way, I should note that Isaac also has eczema, a serious skin condition. I don't know why I would think you like damaged characters, or not sure. Let's talk about the Temple Mount, because a fair amount of the action takes place, but the focus is on Jerusalem in general. But let's talk a little bit about Har HaBayit. It means so much to Jews and so much to Muslims and even to Christians. In unpacking what's always an explosive topic, and recently very explosive, how did you manage to make it so personal?
Well, when I first started this book, it hadn't become as explosive. I think I was just genuinely interested in the place. At the time while I was writing about the Kabbalists' courtyard, which I knew because I had spent time in Israel in various courtyards of Kabbalists, I was also learning in the Torah. I was learning this teacher who was giving over Vayikra, Leviticus. And this had always been the book that my eyes would glaze over with boredom when I was a kid growing up. But somehow she made it become alive. And somehow the two courtyards became commingled. And, you know, the whole idea of the Holy of Holies, everyone wants to gain entrance to the Holy of Holies, right? That's the most sacred spot. And it just seemed to me that Holy of Holies is really just, it's the human heart. And somehow when I saw the Temple Mount, I was very much aware of the politics of what was going on in terms of the destruction of the of artifacts that are happening up there. But there was the human level as well. It became like a metaphor for me of entering, you know, that sacred place of a human being's heart, which is what happens between Isaac and Mustafa, that they grow to this genuine love for each other.
Which, of course, this being the Middle East, has to end tragically. Does it have to end that way? Could you have ended the book a different way?
I would say, in terms of my story, it had to end that way, because I don't want to do any spoilers for readers, but I think I would prefer not to answer this, because I think it's going to give away the storyline for people.
I don't want to give away the book. So
No, it doesn't have to end tragically.
When you write a book, especially one which is intricately plotted, like in the Courtyard of the Kabbalist, do you know in advance where you're going to go?
That's a good question. I think that I had an idea of where I wanted to end up. I would say it's like the first 25% I know, and then the rest of the 75% is going to be surprising me along the way. Because if it's too predetermined, that means there's something alive that's not quite happening in the moment. And I really have to get into the moment with my characters and follow them. I am the boss, but I have to be open to some of their influence, you know? It's like a marriage, right? We want to be influenced but not controlled, right? So, but I did have an idea where I wanted it to end up. But the last line of the book, which people told me was, you know, the best part for them, that didn't come until years later.
Years later.
Right. I'd gone through a number of drafts with this book.
You know, you talked earlier about how the heart is the true Kodesh Kodeshim, the true Holy of Holies. Your first book, Seven Blessings, is about matchmaking in Israel. And in fact, in the Courtyard of the Kabbalist says a great deal about trying to find one's Bashert, even when you've already found her or found him. Also an interest of yours?
Is being a matchmaker, an interest of mine, you're saying?
Well, certainly in a literary sense it is.
I wish I could say that I have done more. I have made matches in the past, and a number of people have gotten married through, you know, some of my help. But I must say that I haven't made a match in a number of years, to my regret. But interestingly, in the book, in the Courtyard of the Kabbalist, there is a romantic element, there's a courtship element, but there's also the whole idea of Beshert, which is, you know, destined one, the Beshert of work. And work is a very strong theme in the book. People coming not only to the romantic destiny, but their, you know, professional calling. And that, too, has an element, a strong element of Beshert.
What's your next book project?
Well, actually, I just wrote a children's book which came out about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, Mazel Tov.
and another children's book which is coming out. It's funny because I don't write children's books. This sort of happened as a fluke. And that's also coming out. That's about it's a Moroccan folktale. I thought it would give my mother some nachas there, my Sephardic mother from Casablanca. It's set in Casablanca. And I'm working on short stories right now, very intensely. And that's my first true love, is short stories.
I have to say, in reading your work, one feels that one is walking through Jerusalem, you know, having lived there and been there many times. I don't know that anybody has quite captured in such a terse way or such a brief way the experience of actually being there as you do. It's very powerful. Is that intentional? Is that just from having been there so
much? Funny you should say that. That with my first novel, that was definitely, I wanted to immerse people in the Jerusalem experience. And then in the second one, I thought, well, I already did that, so I'm just going to do the very bare minimum to set the scene in this novel. Enough so that it's credible. But people keep, I guess it's so much in my kishkas, whatever came out anyway, it gave a sense of Jerusalem, because I wasn't aiming for that this time around. But I'm very happy that it came through. And, you know, when I'm writing this, I do hope to create a kind of yearning for people to return to Israel and to return to Jerusalem. And if people come out with that sense of, you know, that desire to be there, missing it, longing for it, that makes me feel very good.
You write about Kabbalah. Did you study much Kabbalah when you're in Jerusalem?
I went to classes that were taught by Kabbalists when I was in Israel, and they taught more Hasidic thought than actual Kabbalah. But you know something, it's so funny, there's so many people who are not learning Kabbalah, but they call it Kabbalah.
Yeah.
And then I thought I was learning Hasidus, which turned out to be a lot of it, you know, I learned a lot of Kabbalistic concepts, I'll put it that way. You know, and here in America also, I've studied under various Kabbalists, studying, again, Hasidic thought, Hasidic ideology. And if you've noticed, like the way you put it, like there are Kabbalistic elements inside the book, but I wouldn't say it's pure Kabbalah, because the book is really more interested in Kabbalists as opposed to Kabbalah, and the way people take their knowledge and integrate it and put it into their lives, as opposed to, you know, something more esoteric. And sometimes I find that people can, you know, when I go to different places, that people are hungering for Kabbalah and they want some kind of mystical experience. But to me, the greatest mystical experience is when, you know, human beings can connect in a very profound way. So sometimes I disappoint people in that way, because they're looking for something more woo-woo, you know? And I actually deliberately refrained from going toward the woo-woo. As I was researching the book, and was researching about Kabbalists, every time somebody would tell me a miracle story, my eyes would roll. And I believed them. I believed that the experience was true and they weren't exaggerating. But I just thought it didn't interest me. It didn't compel me. I was interested in like stories that had like a little bit of heaven but a lot of earth in it. That was more where that combo was more appealing to me.
I have to tell you, as a rabbi who's taught Zohar for 11, 12 years now, I think your approach is fantastic, and it captures in a way the mystical and magical relationships between human beings that really are at the soul, the heart of what Kabbalah is trying to explore. In making the connection to God.
Wow. I didn't know you... I have to go check out your class.
Please.
Wonderful.
I want to thank Ruchama King-Fuhrman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. You can find out more from her website, which is ruchamafuhrman.com, RuchamaFuhrman. I think that's right.
I think so. The Fuhrman is a little tricky. Fuhrman. That's right. That's the hard one.
Continued success. I look forward to your next work, short stories or novels. Take your pick. I'll read any of them.
Thank you so much. Very touched.
It's a pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Laura Wetzler, a fine singer, songwriter, and musician, discussing her experience performing at a German synagogue where her great-grandfather served as a cantor before the Holocaust. Our playout from our Passover playlist of particularly pleasurable passages of Pesach song. Here's a setting of Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim from the Psalms of Passover when Israel went out of Egypt by Sepham. My friends, have a Chag Pesach Sameach, a happy holiday of Passover, and a Shavua Tov, a good week of peace.
Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, Bet Yaakov Me'am Elohez, Hayta Yehuda.